Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Do parents and children ever stop getting to know one another? Mary Alice Hostetter puts all of her assumptions about this to the test. Cynthia Nixon, fresh off a Tony win for her performance in the Broadway drama The Little Foxes, reads Mary Alice's essay, Dear Dad, We've Been Gay for a Really Long Time.
The first letter was not mine. Although my brother Charles and I had spent so much time talking about it that I felt some ownership. I was in San Francisco for the Thanksgiving holiday, and we had read and reread the letter he was planning to send to my father, changing a word here and there, rearranging sentences. I suggested he replace gay with homosexual, the word my father was more likely to have heard, usually in the same sentence with abomination, from the pulpit of the Mennonite church he and my mother had attended for decades. I was supportive of my brother, respected his courage, and was flattered that he valued my opinion about something so important, but I didn't fully understand. "You really think he needs to know?" I asked. "How is this going to help him?" "It's not for him," Charles said. "I'm doing this for me. I'm over 60 years old, and he still thinks I'll get married if I find the right woman." "It's not like he's rejected you," I said. "He thinks the sun rises and sets on his doctor sons." "I don't know what he'll do with this, but I need him to know who I am." I told my partner later, "Charles is obsessed with that letter." "Seems like it's important to him for your father to know," she said. "I think our father's doing the best he can," I said. "He never went beyond eighth grade, and he's been a farmer his whole life. His world's pretty narrow. He's 95. Something like this? No telling how he'll take it." "You may as well let it go," she said. The next morning, my brother asked if I wanted to walk with him to the mailbox. The sun was glistening off the buildings on the San Francisco skyline against a brilliant blue sky. We walked to Fillmore, and I watched him drop the letter into the mailbox slot. "There it goes," he said. "No taking it back now," I said. We took the long way home, through Alamo Square Park, the iconic painted ladies lined up in the morning light. "I wonder who'll visit first after he gets the letter," my brother said. "Who'll get to process it with him?" Two of our eight brothers lived near his nursing home in Pennsylvania and checked in on him every week. "I know Abe goes every Wednesday afternoon," I said, "and I think Ike goes on Friday." Abe is a psychiatrist, Ike a retired farmer and Mennonite deacon. There are 12 of us siblings altogether. "Doubt it'll get there by Wednesday," my brother said. My partner and I flew back to Virginia, and the busyness of catching up at work and preparing for the holidays distracted me from wondering when the news would hit the family grapevine. It didn't take long before the reports started trickling in. Each tidbit so remarkable, I began to keep a record so I wouldn't forget. Ike, the farmer brother, was the first one my father showed the letter to. "Did you know this?" my father asked. "Everyone pretty much knows it." "I sure didn't," my father said.
had no idea.
By the following Wednesday, when Abe visited, my father had more questions.
How does this happen?
Abe said, seems some people are just born that way.
Are a lot of them born that way?
About 1 in 10, they estimate.
Well, if it's how people are born, it sure doesn't seem like something that should tear families apart.
That proclamation rippled up and down the family grapevine, and it seemed it should echo down the halls of Fairmont Nursing Home, past the nurses' stations, and across the fields to the plain brick Mennonite churches. After my father received and processed my brother's letter, he seemed to spend a good deal of time in his sunny room contemplating this new reality. It was clear he gave some thought to the 1 in 10 theory, and from his vantage point overlooking the nursing home entrance, he counted off visitors, wondering. He talked to visiting family members about unmarried relatives, neighbors. When my younger brother Sanford visited, my father said, "You know, I've been thinking about Eli." Eli was an Amish neighbor. All those years he worked that farm by himself. I remember when he was younger, he dated girls, but it didn't work out for him. I wonder if that was the story with Eli. Makes me feel bad that he never found someone. And then the question started about me. "It makes me wonder about Mary Alice," my father said. "What about her?"
"I guess you should ask her," Sanford said.
Of course, my father wasn't going to. It wasn't the sort of thing we would talk about. When Sanford told me about the conversation, I knew it was time to clear things up, to let my father know that I was part of the 1 in 10. I could have dispatched a sibling to deliver my news. I could have shouted it to my hearing-impaired father over the phone or on my next visit. A letter seemed like the most reliable way to communicate. After my brother's courageous letter, I knew mine would be anticlimactic, not only because my brothers came first, but also because I was one of 4 daughters, and in our family, especially from my father's point of view, nothing about being a daughter appeared to have the same import as it would have from a son. So I wrote my letter and sent it. But during my next visit, the subject never came up. My father was as welcoming to my partner and me as he always had been. I considered asking him about the letter, but never did. Had my mother still been alive, I think the conversation would have been outsourced to her. They had lived at the nursing home together for a couple of years before she died at 95. Just a few weeks after they celebrated their 74th anniversary. For years after she died, my father glanced toward her chair when he needed to tell her something, and I'm sure he would have liked to know what she thought of the letters. I can only hope she would have been as understanding as my father was. But I'll never know. The nursing home where my parents lived was run by conservative Mennonites and was consistently recognized for the quality of its care and its cleanliness. Many of the staff members considered their work a religious calling. A steady stream of volunteers cleaned the residents' eyeglasses, shined their shoes, massaged feet, and filled the halls and chapels with music. My father ate his meals in the main dining hall, but insisted on a full-size refrigerator in his room to store his Turkey Hill black cherry ice cream, which my brothers made sure he always had. He kept the bowls and spoons in the refrigerator, along with pretzels and pink mints for the children. He served himself a snack each evening. As one of only a handful of men in the nursing home, my father was much sought after by the widows. He made it clear that he had no intention of remarrying, but he did invite some of them over for a bowl of ice cream now and then. His vision of heaven included reuniting with our mother. Although he was longing for that time, he first wanted to live to be 100, or at the very least, live longer than his older brother, who had died just short of 99. In time, my father's focus on who was or wasn't gay abated. The reality blended into the landscape of carefully tended farms, stretching as far as he could see from his nursing home window. Sometimes I like to imagine him sitting in the sunroom with the three other men in his wing, all of them hard of hearing, him shouting, "And I have two children who are gay. What do you make of that?" My father died 10 years ago, a week short of his 100th birthday. I think it gave him peace knowing all 12 of his children had found someone with whom to share their lives. If he's with my mother in heaven, I hope he has brought her up to date on family news. If he's run into Eli up there, his Amish neighbor, I expect he's told him how sorry he is that he had to work the farm by himself all those years. Recently, many of the Mennonite churches in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, decided to split from Mennonite Church USA, which has chosen to allow openly gay members. The only thing as important as church to my parents was family. I'm glad they didn't live to see this time. Would church or family win? Would my father speak up against his church to tell people, it's not the sort of thing to tear families apart? Last May, after 18 years together, my longtime partner and I married. I don't know what my parents would have made of that. But I wish they could have been there.
Cynthia Nixon, reading Mary Alice Hostetter's essay, Dear Dad, We've Been Gay for a Really Long Time. Mary Alice shares a bit from that letter to her dad after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with a first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
We're back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Mary Alice Hostetter lives in Charlottesville, Virginia, with her wife, Terry. She says she never realized how important it was to come out to her father until she did. And while the letter never came up in conversations, she assumes he read it because he never again asked her siblings about why she wasn't married. Just recently, she was cleaning out some files on her computer and ran across the letter. She read some of it to us.
I have a great deal of respect for Charles and his courage to be honest with you. I also have a great deal of respect for the way in which you have responded to that honesty. If all parents were as understanding as you, it would make the world a better place for people like us, who so many want to judge and persecute. I appreciate the example you have given us in accepting people for who they are and in honoring family, no matter what our differences might be.
Mary Alice says her father was a simple man, a farmer. He was also deeply religious.
I think his response came from a place of sort of very simple, basic, practical thinking. If someone says, that's how you're born, then it doesn't make sense to make a deal out of it. It's just who you are. So I think sometimes there's a great deal of wisdom in that level of simplicity, and that is where his response came from.
She says the bulk of the responses to her essay were positive, and she's thankful for that. But it was the act of publishing these words that made this a transformative experience.
When I saw the article in the Times, the essay, of course, I had moments of disbelief. There would have been a time in my life that nothing would have been more unlikely than that level of honesty, even among people I know fairly well. So seeing it there in the New York Times was just remarkable and made me feel so, I don't want to say powerful, but something like powerful.
Mary Alice Hostetter. She lives in Charlottesville, Virginia, and is currently writing a memoir about her life growing up in a Mennonite community. After the break, Daniel Jones on how modern love has become a way to track social change.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with a first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Dan Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times. He says over the past 13 years, submissions to the column have mirrored societal change.
How coming out, when this column started, how coming out as gay, just for the average person, could still be a story, then it quickly became not a story. But there's sort of this delayed effect depending on the community you're in. And typically, and this is a good example in Mary Alice's story, the people are much older. They've been together for decades in some cases. So this is a case where coming out, in 2016, when this piece ran, is still a story in certain communities and a very moving one. And it made this idea of social change, it really just makes you think that it's dominoes being knocked over until the very last one is knocked over. Like, it's not something that goes to a certain point and then stops.
Dan manages the Modern Love Facebook page, so keep up with his musings throughout the week by checking out facebook.com/modernlove. Cynthia Nixon says the stoicism of the father in this piece appealed to her.
My mother's mother's family is from Missouri. And I always remember when my mother started seeing a man that she was eventually with for almost 35 years who was Jewish, when she talked to her great aunt, who was like a second mother to her, she was curious to know whether
my great aunt would have any negative reaction to that. And my great aunt Edna sort of scrunched up her face and said, oh, there's so much more important things than that kind of thing to worry about. And that my great aunt's attitude and her proclamation to me echoed the patriarch's sentiment. And I think there is running through Middle America that kind of people making up their mind and not making a fuss and having what we would consider a degree of enlightenment, but it's just sort of practical common sense, too. Why would we worry about such a thing?
Thanks again to Cynthia Nixon for reading this week's essay. You can see her in the film The Only Living Boy in New York. It's in theaters now. Coming up next week, Nico Tortorella of the TV Land show Younger reads an essay about a young man who learns more than he expected about himself during his first year of college.
My ideas about love and sexuality had been black and white. There was no room in my mind for gray areas. You were either gay or straight. And I had never dreamed of falling in love with anyone but a woman. While I had wondered what it would be like to be with a man, I had ignored that curiosity, assuming I was heterosexual only.
Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Perotti, and Amory Sievertson. Additional sound design by Matt Reed. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. You can always get more Modern Love on Facebook. Join the community at facebook.com/modernlove. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll see you next week.